questions on anything? So you all did better than average on the first exam, and you did even better on this exam. So the median person picked up 5 renormalized points. It's basically half a grade, this exam compared to the first exam. That hit a big range of deviation. So somebody went up 31 points, like kind of that's the difference between a C and an A, and somebody went down 31 points. So big range of variations. Most people, of course, did mostly the same. Most people were within 6 points of their previous score. There are screencasts of the solutions, just like there were of the old exams, online. So if you want to check those out, particularly before the final, say you can. Oh, and you remember the usual game in the black in a box, there should be your raw score equals your normalized score equals a letter grade. And then down at the bottom in red, there's your homework score since the last exam, divided by the high in the the class. Questions? Yes.
What should we do if we're worried about our grade?
Do better. I guess I'm not sure how to answer that question. The way I tell people is the best way to study for these exams is to actually work an old exam and bring it in and have me kind of grade it in front of you. But people aren't doing that, and they're doing well, so I don't know, maybe there are other ways of doing it too. I think it's obvious if you look at the old exams, they're very similar to your exams, maybe too similar to your exams. So if you understand the old exams, you should be set for these exams. More questions? Keeping up with reading the book is also helpful too, of course. Okay, so we started last time talking about the sun, and the sun seems to be kind of defined something that is steady, and I know best guess is that the sun hasn't changed its brightness in human history by 0.5%. But I claim that that's an unexpected fact, that explosions really are the usual case. And the logic is that if we have some sort of reaction, be it chemical, be it nuclear, it's all going to start with some sort of collision. And if the reaction releases energy, we expect that's going to lead to higher temperature, and that's going to lead to faster motion of the atoms. And that means we're going to get more collisions a second, which means more reactions per second, which means more energy release. This is sometimes called a vicious cycle or positive feedback. And it explains why explosions occur. Now, I mean, as a matter of fact, explosions seem kind of rare, and we usually have chemical reactions in which two different things are required, say oxygen and natural gas, or flour and oxygen, and we avoid explosion by putting them in different spots and not mixing them together homogeneously. That's not the case of the sun, right? The reaction just requires protons, and they are already, can't separate the protons from the protons. They're already nicely mixed together. The other way we kind of avoid explosions, if you think about something like sugar is quite burnable, but we can keep it on our tabletop. We just make sure it doesn't have the conditions to start the burning process. That also doesn't apply to the sun, because the sun is currently hot enough to get those reactions to go, and we know because it's quote-unquote burning, that is to say it is reacting. So something has to be keeping this positive feedback cycle from occurring inside the sun, and the answer is supplied by a theorem called the virial theorem. And like any theorem, it's got an if part and a then part. And if you're made out of a normal gas, and on the exam people commonly convert normal to natural, right? That's not what it says, normal gas, and you're held together by gravity, those conditions actually pretty much define what a star is. Then you have the following situation, that if you add energy, instead of the temperature getting hotter, it gets cooler. The star expands a little bit, and the reverse is also the case. So if you remove energy, the star gets a little bit hotter and it contracts a little bit. So that means that instead of having positive feedback where more gives you more, we have negative feedback where if you go a little bit extra, you automatically turn down the thermostat and you automatically go slower. So we looked at the particular reactions that power the sun, so-called proton-proton chain. Overall, what's happening is four hydrogens are turning into helium. And we've got lots of hydrogen in the sun. It's basically 3/4 hydrogen by mass and 1/4 helium by mass and a little bit of everything else mixed into the sun. The way nuclear reactions work is a little bit surprising. So it turns out that the most stable stuff is iron-56. So you can release energy by starting with something small and building it up. That's fusion, and that's what's going on in the sun. Or you can start with something big and break it apart. Either way, you're going downhill and you have energy to release. So in the bombs that were used on Japan, uranium was broken apart into two pieces, and those were fission bombs or uranium bombs. Okay, so then we talk some about the insides of the sun. So starting from the center, we have the core where conditions are hot enough that we can actually have these thermonuclear reactions running. We have the radiative zone where light is shining through still material. The outer 30% of the sun is actually kind of boiling. We have convection going on where hot stuff is rising and cool stuff is falling. What seems to be the edge of the sun, what seems to be the boundary of the sun, surface of the sun, that's called the photosphere, and it's not really different from any other part of the sun. The only thing that's special about it is that it's become opaque. Usually hydrogen and helium are transparent gases, but the temperatures are just right there to form a negative hydrogen ion, and it turns out that ions don't have to have the same absorption spectra as the atoms, and the negative hydrogen ion actually is fairly opaque and it causes the absorption region. So up here we don't have negative hydrogen ions, so the material is generally speaking transparent. Inside we have relatively opaque stuff. Incidentally, that kind of begs a question about this radiative zone, because the way I've described it, you're probably thinking about light shining through transparent material, and that's not what it's like. So it turns out on average light can only go about a centimeter before it's absorbed. So this is worse than being in a cloud, right? I mean, you can imagine that you would see just a centimeter in front of you if you were in this material. So it's more like the light is bouncing around inside a cloud, and it's slowly working its way out inside the radiative zone. So on average, it takes something like 1 million years for a photon that's created in the core to work its way out to the outer edges of the sun. The chromosphere, the name chromo suggests that its color, it is actually kind of tinted red from the emission lines we saw of hydrogen. And above there, we've got the very hot, but not very dense corona. And the sun is constantly shedding material in what's called the solar wind. The things we see as surface features, you remember Galileo saw sunspots, they're all strongly influenced by the magnetic field. So we're talking about plasmas at this point, ionized gases, and it turns out that magnetic fields interact strongly with plasmas, and they are basically important in almost all of these sorts of features. So the sunspots were dark features on the sun. They're not really dark, they're just a few thousand degrees cooler than the sun, and since the brightness of material depends strongly on the temperature, they look a little bit darker, but they're actually brighter than anything you've ever seen, because you've never seen anything that's as hot as the sunspot. Prominences are material that's being supported above the photosphere by a magnetic field, typically in loops. Spicules are material that is kind of, we really don't understand exactly what's going on in spicules, but it looks kind of like grass leaves that are poking up from the photosphere into the chromosphere. Flares are dramatic releases of magnetic energy over a very short period of time, explosions as it were, but the energy is not chemical or nuclear, it's actually magnetic field energy release. I skipped over granules because they're kind of the odd guy out. They're not much influenced by the magnetic fields. And in that case, we see just the tops and bottoms of kind of the boiling nature of the convective zone. Questions on any of that stuff? Let's take a look at some pictures. So this is a picture of, if you look at the sun normally, you're just going to burn out your eyes, right? So if you're going to detect things like sunspots, you're going to look through very opaque glass. That's how the Chinese did it, or do some sort of image projection to see the dark surfaces on the sun. But to see a lot of these features of the sun, the best thing to do is to have the bright surface of the sun, the photosphere, covered up by the moon in a solar eclipse. And what we see here are prominences that are sticking up above the limb of the sun, the limb of the sun and the limb of the moon. This white area out here, that's the corona, and you can kind of see that it is, stripy. Maybe it looks kind of like cat fur or something. So this is the magnetic field that's influencing the concentration of the coronal material. So here we have a sunspot. So they're pretty small on the surface of the sun. The biggest ones you can detect with your eye if you're looking through smoked glass or projecting it. Here's kind of a close-up view. And again, you see this kind of furry, linear sort of behavior that's indicative of the magnetic field. We'll see a close-up of it in a second, but here you see the kind of spotted surface of the sun. Each one of these little areas is the top of a convection cell. So these are the granules that we're looking at. Here's a picture of how the sunspots work. So the purple is indicating a magnetic field that is threading through the surface of the sun. So this material is confined. It's not taking part in the boiling of the rest of the sun, so it has a chance to cool off. And here we have the rest of the photosphere. So this is a prominence. This is actually taken in X-ray. So here we see a magnetic loop that is suspending solar material in the chromosphere. If we look at the same picture with ultraviolet light, here we have both smaller and larger prominences. I'm not sure I see with my eye there a small one, but here's a huge one. Like there's a little one. You see these surface features here that are called filaments. Those are just prominences that you're looking through. So something is sticking out that we can't see because we're looking at the surface. Here's a close-up of the granules. So again, this outer part of the sun is actually kind of boiling. So here we have hot material that's rising, and on these boundaries we have cool material that's falling. And that's how the energy is being transferred in these outer layers of the sun. So here's another picture of the sun where we've got kind of a normal prominence and a huge prominence in the kind of the spotted surface of the sun. So a flare is an explosion, and they look a lot like prominences maybe, but these things would be over in kind of minutes as opposed to weeks. So the prominences last for long periods of time. These flares are explosions that are occurring on the surface of the sun. And they can lead to what are called coronal mass ejections. So here's what the sun would look like. This is an obscuring disk. This is a picture from space. And here we have a whole lot of material that is being blown off the surface of the sun. If that material sweeps by the Earth, that's the situation that would produce northern lights, as we said. Questions about the sun so far? Okay, so this is kind of the start of genuinely new material today. So it turns out that sunspots are not always present. So we're about here on this graph, and until recently there have been few sunspots visible on the surface of the sun. And you can see that there are periods of time when there are more sunspots and periods of time when there are relatively few sunspots. And roughly speaking, if you count it up, there's about 11 years between periods when we have lots of sunspots. So this is called the sunspot cycle. And not only is the number of sunspots changing over time, but the location of those sunspots change over time. So a sunspot cycle starts with sunspots occurring at kind of mid-latitudes of both hemispheres. And then as the cycle proceeds, the sunspots move towards the equator, and then they disappear, and then we restart the cycle. Okay, so here's kind of the current situation. So we've just come through a sunspot minimum in 09, and we think we're starting to work our way back up to a sunspot maximum. The predictions are actually that the sunspot maximum won't be as big as the previous maximum. And generally speaking, we've been undershooting those projections already. So maybe the peak will be even smaller than it's been, generally speaking. So what's causing the sunspot cycle, and what's going on? Well, remember that all of these phenomena on the so-called surface of the sun are strongly influenced by a magnetic field. And you may know that the Earth's magnetic field typically reverses occasionally on kind of a million-year schedule. That is to say, the needle that currently points north on your compass a million years from now might be pointing south. And this all may beg the question of what's the source of either the Earth's or the sun's magnetic field. So you're probably most used to thinking about bar magnets like this that are just made out of special material that is able to maintain a magnetic field. But there are other sorts of magnets around. So these are permanent magnets. We also have electromagnets. I'm sure you've seen the pictures of the things picking up cars and dropping them, just holding them up by magnetic fields. So it turns out that permanent magnets, material like that maintains a magnetic field, that can't exist at even moderately high temperatures. So there can't be permanent magnets as the source of the Earth's magnetic field or the sun's magnetic field. It's simply way too hot. So the only way these guys could be producing magnetic fields is by having an electrical current that's providing that magnetic field. And that's problematic because, you know, you need a battery in order to power an electromagnet. You need some sort of source of electric current. So somehow or other, we have to have electrical currents flowing inside both the Earth and the Sun and pretty much all the planets. So one sort of hint is that the Moon doesn't seem to have a magnetic field, although it probably had a magnetic field in the past. And the reason we think that's the case is that the Moon is basically a solid object. You know that the Earth has a liquid core on the inside, so we have to have, apparently, a flowing fluid for the Sun. That's going to be a gas. For the Earth, it's going to be this molten iron core that we've got. So maybe the first thing to ask is, why are these fluids moving at all? Why haven't they, you know, you can stir your coffee for a while, but if you wait 4 billion years, the coffee is not going to be moving anymore. So what's causing this flow? Well, it's the same thing that we were talking about before. It's convection. The inside of the Earth, the inside of the Sun is very hot, and we have hot material rising and falling inside the center of the Earth and at the edge of the Sun in these convection zones. So that flowing material presumably plays a big role for making the electric field, but you don't worry about the water on your stove that is convecting, spontaneously producing an electromagnet. So the other thing that's needed is that the fluid has to be electrically conducting. Right? So the metal that is inside the Earth, the iron, as it flows, that's a convecting, conducting fluid. And in the case of the Sun, we have the plasma made out of ions, so it's electrically conducting, convecting fluid. So I think that that's the source of the electric currents that that drive both the Earth and the Sun, and kind of the idea is this is a self-propagating material. So in order to make an electric current, how does NSP do it? So how do you make a generator? Well, it turns out all you need is a magnetic field plus a wire that's moving through that magnetic field. So kind of in a storybook sort of form for a generator, you would have north and south poles, and you would just have a wire loop that is spinning inside that magnetic field. And that's all that's required to make an electric current. Now, in fact, the way NSP does it, and the way we think the Sun does it, is that you can have this magnetic field plus a moving conductor. Right, so inside the Earth and the Sun, the moving conductor is this convecting fluid. That thing can make an electric field that is, can make a current that is then going to make the magnetic field that is going to cause the whole thing to go. So it's kind of another case of positive feedback where an existing magnetic field, when a conductor moves through it, makes an electric current, which makes the magnetic field, and so it goes. But if you think about it, that sort of biting your own tail situation is one that is subject to being broken apart, right? So if something stops the magnetic field, then it's going to stop the electric current and it's going to reduce the magnetic field even more. So it's not necessarily something that will maintain itself automatically forever, and that seems to be the case. We have situations where the magnetic field inside the Earth, kind of trick question, if this is the North Pole, the magnetic field inside the Earth, that has to be a south pole, right? Because the things that have N are going to be attracted to it. So currently we have a south magnetic pole inside the Earth like that, but this thing spontaneously reverses on kind of a million year time scale. In the case of the Sun, we think that, well, we know that exactly the same thing is happening, but on a much shorter time scale. This change in the presence of sunspots is associated with a reversal of the Sun's magnetic field. So under these circumstances, we might have a north pole in the north part of the Sun, and then we have in the north part of the Sun a south pole, and then we have a north pole again in the north pole of the Sun. So a full 22-year cycle is the time it takes for a full reversal of the magnetic field inside of the Sun. And again, there's no guarantee that the process is going to turn itself on once it's turned itself off. And there's moderately good evidence that the sunspot cycle has not been continuously active through human history. That on periods of hundreds of years ago, there were times when there weren't sunspots. The data for that isn't great because we haven't really been good at observing sunspots every day until like the last century. So the observations are kind of spotty, and the fact that no one is reporting any sunspots in the 1700s, for example, may mean that they just weren't looking. But generally speaking, people think that the absence of data is suggesting an absence of a reversing magnetic field in the sun. So currently we have a magnetic field that is reversing under this 11-year cycle, but we think that probably there are times when that's happening and times when it's not happening. Okay, questions? Okay, so the Earth, anything that has a conducting, convecting fluid inside of it, planet, star, not unlikely that it has an associated magnetic field. And that magnetic field, the Earth's magnetic field doesn't do much to affect the Earth's weather because the atmosphere isn't electrically conducting. So whether there's a magnetic field or not, the wind can blow. But for plasmas, magnetic field has a huge effect on its motion. And those are what's causing these so-called surface features, you might call them atmospheric features, inside the sun. Okay. So, what's it like inside the sun? So here are kind of plots of the temperature, the density, where the energy is being produced, luminosity is the energy of the sun, and kind of the composition of the sun at various spots from the core of the sun to the surface of the sun. And kind of no surprise, as we go inside of the sun, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. And in the central part of the sun, the temperature is like 15 million degrees hot. So remember, that's way hotter than the surface of the sun, which is only like 6,000 degrees hot. So we have a huge range in temperatures. But the change in density is even more striking. So the surface of the sun, the gas that's there is less dense than the air in this room. Right? So there's almost vacuum at what we call the surface of the sun, hardly anything. On the other hand, the core of the sun is about 10 times denser than lead. So think about gas that has been so compressed that it's 10 times the density of lead. That's kind of the situation at the core of the sun. So we have huge temperatures and huge densities, and that's exactly what we need to have huge numbers of collisions per second in order to have these nuclear reactions occur. So what this graph is showing, maybe it's a little bit obscure, is that most of the energy production happens in a limited region of space. Right, so there are no thermonuclear reactions happening out here. There is no addition to the luminosity of the sun out here. All that's happening is the energy that is released at the center of the sun is working its way out. And I've used this shorthand about the composition of the sun, and I'm going to make this statement lots of times, and it's a source of potential confusion. Of course, what's happening inside the sun is that hydrogen is being converted to helium. So that means that there must be ash building up in the center of the sun, and that's the case. There is less hydrogen, right? About half of the hydrogen has been used up in the center of the sun. So when I talk about the composition of stars, I'm usually talking about the composition on the surface, because that's the only thing we can measure directly. Stuff is being used up. In this case, hydrogen is being converted to helium. So when we had just 25% helium at the edge of the sun, inside of the sun, there'd be more like, I don't know, 60% helium. Okay. So how do we know this? How can we make these sorts of graphs that give us this sort of information? How do we know what's inside the Earth, right? A moment ago I said that there's a liquid core inside the Earth. So there they're kind of two approaches. The first approach, which works great, is basically just to use you think you know how gases work, and if you just put the equations that describe how the how gases work, then you can calculate what the situation has to be on the inside. And we're certainly not interested in these equations directly, but let's think about what these equations are. So the first equation is the equation we talked about before. Simply because the gas weighs something, as we go down deeper and deeper in this ocean, the pressure has to get higher and higher and higher. And so what we said then is the change in pressure depends on the density of the material, the weight of the water as it were, times the acceleration of gravity times the distance we've gone in or out from the center of the planet or star or ocean or air. Same thing applies. The deeper you go, the pressure has to increase because pressure is basically just the weight of the overlying layers. So this goes under the fancy name of hydrostatic equilibrium. So you remember how we proved this was just by showing that, you know, this piece of air isn't falling, so there must be a force that's pushing it up as much as gravity is pushing it down. And that that force that's pushing it up is the difference in pressure between the top and the bottom of this hunk of air. Okay, so the other relationship that's going to be important is sometimes called the ideal gas law. And this law says that the pressure divided by, I'll put in some constants here that I'll talk about in a second, but basically the pressure divided by the temperature tells you what the density of the air is. Right, so we can have high density air if we have high pressure or if we have low temperature. So, I don't know, we don't really care about these constants. This constant K is named after the dead physicist Boltzmann, and you could look it up in a book. This thing here is the mass of an atom. Okay, so the sun is kind of an unusual place. We have a high density and we have a high temperature, which means we have to have really huge pressures in order to correspondingly have a high density and a high temperature all at the same time.
And those high pressures would keep
the sun basically? No. If anything, you would think high pressures would cause it to explode, right? Things that are at high pressure are going to be being pushed out. So the thing that causes it not to explode is this virial theorem. So absent this virial theorem, so if the sun were not made of a normal gas, something that's not a normal gas, for example, is called the degenerate gas. We'll talk about it in a few weeks. Some stars are made out of degenerate gas, and they do explode then. So the high pressure is just a consequence of having a whole lot of mass, and it has a whole lot of weight, and pressure is just the weight of that stuff. So at the center of the Earth, of course, we have fairly high pressures because we have the weight of all of that rock. It's even, of course, hugely more so in the case of the sun because the sun has hugely more mass than the Earth has. We've also got the force of gravity. Right, we know that the force of gravity depends on your distance, like 1 over r squared. And finally, we have an equation for energy production. Maybe I should use nuclear energy release because of course it's not actually produced. And this is a complicated formula that depends on the pressure and the density and the temperature of the material that we're talking about, right? At higher temperatures, we're going to get even more nuclear energy release per second than we're going to get under other circumstances. So as usual in this class, we're not really interested in the details of these equations, but the upshot is, particularly in the 1950s, people could put those equations into their computer and they could crank out ideas about what was going on inside the sun. Well, you worry about that sort of stuff, right? I mean, you think you know what's going on and you've given the numbers to your computer, but is it really what's going on? It would be nice to have some sort of direct evidence of what the interior of the sun is like. So in the 50s, people didn't have any way of directly measuring what was going on inside of the sun. But they did have ways of directly measuring what's going on inside the Earth. So how can we learn what's going on inside the Earth? Say again? Well, drilling is really ineffective. So the deepest bits go down like 10 kilometers, and the size of the Earth is 6,000 kilometers. So just the very apple skin part is all we can touch. The deepest mines don't compare to the deepest drillings that have gone on.
Really good metal detectors.
Say again?
Really high power metal detectors.
Well, the metal detectors don't really help. They actually can detect, so that, again, this is all very surface stuff, right? And so if I stare at the ground, it's opaque and I can't see very far. And drilling and digging, none of those things get me beyond the core.
Could it possibly be something to do with those gravity detecting instruments that you're talking about, using those in different parts of here?
So you can do that. You can, and people, so basically people use both the magnetic field of the Earth and the gravitational field of the Earth to figure out what's down underground. But it really just gives you the very surface layers, things that you might be interested in for mining. And we're interested in going hundreds and thousands of kilometers deep. So I don't know, maybe Superman could see inside the Earth and with his X-ray vision or whatever and see what's going on in there. But Superman seems to be a rare occurrence. Well, so light doesn't penetrate the Earth very far. Is there any other wave that penetrates the Earth that we can use to see? Say again? Well, so radar, it turns out that the Earth is fairly opaque, even to radar. So you can get down hundreds of kilometers, but not real far. Say again? Yeah, so sonar is sound. Sonar in particular usually is referring to liquids sending sound through water, but we can listen. Sound is a perfectly good wave, and the Earth is transparent to sound, so we can use sound to measure what's going on below us. And we have a great source of sound, right? We've got earthquakes. So we have these devices that are called seismometers that measure how the sound from an earthquake has propagated through the Earth. And using this sort of instruments, we can hear cases where sound is bouncing off something, and we can locate where those layers are inside the Earth. And just as you can use computed tomography, those are these cases where we use a series of x-rays to figure out what's inside of a human body, we can do the same thing with the Earth. So we can use these sound waves going in lots of different directions from some earthquake in order to compute what the inside of the Earth is like. So seismometers, very important in figuring out these layers that are inside of the Earth. That isn't the topic of this course, but I'll just mention that we do have, of course, a rigid part, a mantle and a crust. Then we have a liquid part. And inside that, there's a solid part, the so-called solid inner core of the Earth. Okay, so sound travels through material that we can't see through, and we can use that wave to figure out what the inside of the Earth is like. And people have been doing this since, I don't know, 1900 or something like that. It has a long history for geologists. But it looks bad. Yep.
You say that the inside of the Earth is liquid. Is it, I mean, it's still really high pressure, though, so if we were to somehow experience the viscosity, would it be pretty thick, I would think? I mean,
well, so let me talk a little bit about that. So we've all seen liquid lava flowing, at least in pictures, from volcanoes. And the first thing I want to tell you is that has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. That's all very localized stuff, just a few kilometers down. So what I'm talking about is going down thousands of kilometers, and then instead of having liquid rock, we've got liquid iron at very high temperature and pressure. And it turns out that under these situations, the iron is less viscous than water. So if you had this in a cup, it would, you know, it would swirl around. It's not thick like tar. It's very happily flowing, and of course it's the flowing of that iron that's producing the magnetic field that is the Earth's magnetic field. Now you may occasionally hear about stuff that is kind of like tar that seems to be solid but over millions of years is flowing. That's actually in this outer region that I've labeled as being more or less solid, so-called mantle of the Earth. So it's a great topic to talk about, continents that are in motion, this thin film that's moving along this somewhat liquid layer. But here I'm talking about really liquid layers. Questions? Say again? So that's the same material that is liquid is solid. So it's iron nickel. It's metal that's going on. And I mean, I hope you can see I'm trying to avoid talking about this. It turns out that it's really iffy. So there are kind of two ways that you can make a solid. You can cool it off, or you can put it under high pressure. And obviously it's getting hotter as we go towards the center of the Earth. It's not getting cooler, but it's also getting higher pressure. So there's a really kind of interesting match so that we actually get a solid core. The pressure kind of is increasing faster than the temperature. And so the stuff that is solid just outside of it, the stuff that is liquid just outside of it is solid at literally the center of the Earth. So we've got a solid inner core, a liquid outer core. We've got this kind of tarry type stuff, the mantle, and then we've got a fully solid crust that's on the outer parts. And if you want to learn more, you can take the other class. Other questions? We can take geology, or we have a class in planetology. We have 211. Other questions? Well, okay, so I got to talk about the Earth for a while, but how does this help? Because seismometers are, you know, complicated electrical devices that sit on the surface of the Earth. Nothing human has been planted on the so-called surface of the sun, and if it would, it would burn up, and if it would, it would sink to the bottom, right? So it doesn't look like it's a good shot to make seismometers for the sun. But, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago, people realized that we do have seismometers that we can use on the sun. So the idea is that the sun is vibrating, and we want to measure those vibrations as a way of learning what's inside the sun. But if the surface is vibrating, then the Doppler effect means that the light that we observe from Earth is going to be very slightly shifted. And it's a hugely small amount because these vibrations of the sun are not super fast. But it's with careful measurement, it's enough to in fact measure the vibrations on the surface of the sun from Earth. So we actually do a better job of instrumenting the surface of the sun, because with one telescope we can observe the whole sun, well, half of the sun simultaneously. So we can get, we have the equivalent of having seismometers current always monitoring the 50% of the sun. So we have really good data on this. These vibrations that are occurring inside the sun. And as a result, we have really good data on what the interior of the sun is like, better than we have for the Earth. So we actually can measure directly these sorts of properties with an accuracy of about 0.5% for what the inside of the sun is like. Okay, so helioseismometry, which is what our book calls it, solar seismometry is just as good. That's using the vibrations of the sun triggered to us via the Doppler effect to learn what the interior of the sun is like, just like we use seismometry to figure out what the interior of the Earth is like. It's a relatively recent one decade, two decades sort of phenomena for figuring out what the interior of the sun is. And it largely confirmed what we had had by computer calculations. Certainly there were lots of new things that were learned. But the broad picture that computer calculations had given us was turned out to be correct, was verified. Well, again, thinking back about two decades, there is a big problem. So we thought we knew what the interior of the sun was like, and we know that these nuclear reactions are producing neutrinos. And neutrinos are another thing that the sun is transparent to. So those neutrinos that are produced at the center of the sun, they actually happily travel through the entire surface, through the entire radius of the sun and leave the surface and travel past the Earth. And since we know how much energy is being released inside of the sun, we know how many times this cycle is going around per second, we know how many neutrinos, or thought we knew, how many neutrinos should be produced per second from the sun. Now, neutrinos are about the least interacting thing you can think about. So a typical neutrino can go through a light year of lead and not be stopped. So that sounds like it's going to be very, very difficult to detect these neutrinos on Earth. But if you have a big enough body of detection equipment, and if you have a huge flux of neutrinos, and we do, you can actually detect these neutrinos from the sun. So this was done in a mine in, I think it was South Dakota. And what the neutrino detector consisted of was basically a railroad tank car full of cleaning fluid, something that had lots of chlorine in it. It wasn't carbon tet, it was actually, I think it was that. Oops, six. But the key thing is it was just a non-toxic way of storing lots of chlorine, because it turns out that if a neutrino interacts with chlorine, it'll turn it into argon. Now again, there are huge numbers of neutrinos that are being produced by the sun. It's hugely unlikely for any neutrino to change a chlorine nuclei into an argon nuclei. And it turns out that in a month, maybe a dozen argon nuclei were expected to be produced in this tank car. So, you know, talk about needle in a haystack. But the people who did this experiment thought they could detect every single argon ion that was produced by neutrinos. Argon being an inert gas helped, And so they carefully did this all up, and it turns out we were short. Only got about 1/3 of the neutrinos that we expected. So this was called the solar neutrino problem. And, you know, the first guess was that the experiment was just being done wrong. I mean, it's a very complicated experiment trying to detect things that are very small. So for several decades, people were repeating this experiment with different materials. There's a big pile of gallium that the Russians put together to try and measure this. But this thing was repeated many, many times, and it always came up short. And people tried to invent reasons someplace that we could be going wrong. So for example, sometimes people thought that maybe the sun acted like your furnace, right? Your furnace is sometimes on, sometimes off, to produce an average amount of heat so that it stays pretty steady. So maybe the thermonuclear reactions going on inside the sun are currently off, and maybe in the future they're going to get turned on. It turns out that if the temperature were a little bit lower, there'd be fewer neutrinos being produced, but there wouldn't be enough energy released to be heating the sun. So a long period of time when people were trying to resolve this problem. And generally speaking, people figured that the solution had to do with the fact that we didn't understand what the sun was like. But the solution to the problem turns out to be the neutrino. The neutrino was the guy who wasn't acting the way we thought it was acting. So you might remember when we were talking about particles, we said there are actually three different types of neutrinos. There's a neutrino that's partnered with the electron, there's a neutrino that's partnered with the muon, there's a neutrino that's partnered with the tau. And we usually think of particles maintaining their identity. So if you shine an electron in one end of a box, you expect an electron to come out that same box. It turns out that neutrinos aren't like that, that one type can become another. This is called neutrino oscillation. So the type of neutrinos that are produced inside the sun are electron neutrinos, and quite naturally, the type of neutrinos that people were trying to detect were electron neutrinos. But what was happening between the Earth and the Sun is the electron neutrinos were oscillating into the other types of neutrinos, and hence were not being detected by the various nuclear detection schemes that had been arranged. And the 1/3 is simply a matter that we were getting kind of an equal mix of all three types of neutrinos. So 2/3 of the neutrinos were in mu and tau form, and only 1/3 was in the type that we were going to detect. So this seems to be a solved problem at this point. All of the details haven't been worked out yet, but pretty much everyone thinks that the solution to the problem is not that the experiments were wrong, but rather that the neutrino is more complicated than we figured. So the solar neutrino problem was one problem that we had in understanding the sun. The other problem I already hinted at earlier, and that is the temperature of the corona. So here, if we move inside of the sun, temperature works in a fully rational way, right? As you get closer to the furnace, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. That's kind of the only way it can work. So here's where if we go inside the sun, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. But it turns out if we go the other way from the photosphere, it gets a little bit hotter, like 10,000 degrees hot, but then suddenly it gets hugely hot, 1,000,000 degrees hot. So this is close to the sun, but I don't care how close you are to the furnace, you can't get hotter than the thing that's heating you. And the surface of the sun is only 6,000 degrees hot. So the surface of the sun cannot be the thing that's heating the corona. Even though it's sitting right next to the corona, it can't be the thing that's heating it, because you can't heat it, can't heat something no matter how you try. It's a fundamental law of thermodynamics. You can't heat something hotter than the thing that's doing the heating. So this is a currently unresolved problem, I guess is what I would say, at least in detail unresolved, but we know what the solution has to be. It's just a matter of working out the details, I guess. The only way something can get to 1,000,000 degrees if it's being heated by something that is 1,000,000 degrees or hotter. So it must be that the source of whatever is heating the corona has to be inside the sun where it's 1,000,000 degrees hot. So something has to be shining from this region through all of this material, even though it's opaque material, to hit the corona. And we actually think that the source, it turns out that this region, the region between the convection zone and the radiation zone, that is about the right temperature to be the thing that's heating the corona. So what could go through all of that opaque material? Yeah, sound. It's got to be sound. Right, so we know that the sun is vibrating. It's the loudest rock concert in existence. So somehow or other, the sound that's being produced at the base of this convection zone, that must somehow or other travel through the sun, and that sound energy, like a breaking wave, must deposit its energy in the corona. It's the only possible answer. Now, I put sound in quotes because when we have a plasma that is magnetized, then there's more than the usual types of sound. So this goes under the complicated name of magnetohydrodynamics. So this is sound that's not just based on compressing the air, we can also have compressed magnetic fields. So it's probably some combination of sound and a magnetic field vibration that is being produced at the base of the convection zone and is propagating out to the corona in order to heat it. But the exact details are not worked out. That's just the way it has to be, unless the laws of thermodynamics are wrong, which no one's betting on, not me at least. Questions? So we had one problem, the solar neutrino problem. We think that's solved. People are still working on the heating of the corona problem, but broadly speaking, we know pretty much what has to be the case. Questions about the sun? I guess there's one other detail that maybe I should mention, because I think it's confusing. And that goes under the name of the differential rotation of the sun. So let me talk about that first and then show that slide. So historically, if you're going to determine the rotation rate of a planet, what you're going to do is look at some surface feature and see how long it takes to go around. So the surface features that we have on the sun that last for the month that it takes for the sun to revolve once are sunspots. So people would follow these sunspots and figure out how long it takes them to go around. And what they found is that close to the equator, the sun is going faster than it is at the poles. The the rotation rate doesn't seem to be a constant. So this goes under differential rotation. That's obviously impossible for a solid object, but the sun isn't a solid object, it's a gas. So I'll write down differential rotation. So I think you're asking, what's the cause of the seasons?
Yeah, well, we kind of said the sun, but like in the fall, like right now, how it seems like it's bitterly cold, even though it's a sunny day. Is that because the sun is farther, or is it because the ground's just cooled off?
Yeah, so I think you know the answer to those questions, or you did for the last exam. So first of all, the surprising fact, the sun is closest to the Earth in January. So it's not the distance to the sun. So you remember what you notice. I remember my sister telling me, you know, what is it about the winter that the sun is so strong? And I couldn't figure out what she meant. And I think what she meant is that if you walk around now, you're always shading your eyes. The sun is always in your eyes. And that's because the sun is low, close to the horizon. If the sun were way up high, it wouldn't get in your eyes. So the difference between winter and summer is the sun is low, close to the horizon, a large fraction of the time, which means that the sunlight is less direct, less effective. The same beam of light is being spread over a bigger area if it's coming in at a small angle. So it's that angular effect, the fact that the sun is high in the sky in the summer and low in the sky in the winter, that's responsible for the seasons. And of course, that's a result of the changing declination of the sun. And in the end, that's a result of the fact that the Earth has a constant tilt. It's always pointing to Polaris. So it has nothing to do with the sun itself. The sun does seem to be a pretty steady source of heat and light. So another sort of detail, it turns out it's really pretty hard to measure precisely the output of the sun. And that's because the Earth's atmosphere changes the absorption of the atmosphere pretty easily. So at the observatory, it's very easy to measure 10% changes in the transparency of the atmosphere over just an hour with no visible effect. It still just looks like normal dark sky. So with spacecraft, we can get above the atmosphere and we have a chance of measuring pretty accurately the power output of the sun. And that's incidentally called the luminosity. So the luminosity is what size light bulb is the sun, right? Is it a 100-watt light bulb? Is it a 10 to the 23rd watt light bulb? You know, some big number for the number of power output of the sun. It's hard to measure from the ground because of the varying transparency of the Earth's atmosphere. Get above it, and we have a chance of measuring it, but actually there's kind of another problem there. And if you want to measure the change in the power production of the sun over decades, space is a pretty nasty spot, and whatever detector you're going to put up there may be affected by the nasty environment it's in. So the detector may be changing over a decade as opposed to the sun changing over a decade. And it's pretty hard to bring the detector back down to ground and see if it's still working the same way it was when you put it up. So long and short, measuring the luminosity of the sun has been a tough problem. But in the last decade or so, we've done it, and we have pretty good data for the luminosity of the sun. And it is quite constant, changing just a few parts per thousand. So then comes the surprise. When do you think the sun is brightest? When it has sunspots or when it doesn't have sunspots? You would think when it has sunspots, it would be dim, right? Because it's got all that black on it. And it turns out that's not the case. The black must be more than made up for by other hot spots, which are called phages. They're not particularly obvious. So the sun is just a few parts per thousand brighter when it has lots of spots. So as we're going into a sunspot maximum, the sun will be slightly brighter than it was before, but by a small amount. there's a long history of people trying to tie the sunspot cycle to agricultural cycles, right? Good years and bad years for crop growing. And it's hard to see why that would be the case, because the luminosity of the sun really isn't changing at all noticeably during the sunspot cycle. So you can either believe that or not. There's kind of good or bad evidence for it. Questions on the sun? Okay, so I want to kind of finish up, probably continue on next time in this, by just reviewing how do we know about the sun? Where do we get the numbers? And so the primary thing about astronomy, and also usually something that's very difficult to measure, is the distance. So how do we measure the distance to the sun? So you might remember the Greeks pretty inaccurately had measured the distance to the sun, but they at least knew that the distance to the sun was way more than the distance to the moon. How can we accurately measure the distance to the sun? We can actually do it really directly. We can bounce radar signals off the sun and time how long it takes that radar signal to go to the sun and come back. So we have, you know, kind of centimeter accuracy to the distance to the sun. How do we get the radius of the sun? Well, so that's not going to help us get the radius, I don't think. It's that sort of approach that people, that the Greeks used to get the distance to the sun. Kind of like that. So this is just a matter of trigonometry, right? If we know this side, and we know this angle. And remember, we can measure the angle from the top to the bottom of the sun just fine. It's about half a degree. With that information, we can figure out the size of the sun. How about the mass of the sun? Well, we know it's made out of hydrogen and helium, but the size then doesn't help because it's a gas, right? So it can be highly compressed or highly expanded. It could still have the same size and have radically different masses. So usually we think of density telling us something about the composition, right? If I know the size of an iron ball and I know it's made out of iron, I can tell you how much it weighs. But gas is highly compressible. So just knowing that it's made out of hydrogen and helium and has this particular size doesn't tell you the mass.
Does it have something to do with our gravitational pull?
Yeah. Yeah, we can measure the gravitational pull. You might remember Newton's version of Kepler's third law said that if you took the semi-major axis cubed and divided it by the period squared, it was proportional to the mass of the object in the center. So basically gravity. Anytime you have something that's going around something else, you can use Kepler's third law to figure out what the mass is of the object. How about the surface temperature? Right, this 6,000 degrees or so. How do we know that? Well, so the what it's made out of doesn't matter, it turns out. Because any hot object that's producing light is going to produce that black body spectrum. So whether the sun is made out of iron or whether it's made out of hydrogen, if it's 6,000 degrees hot, it's going to produce pretty much the same spectrum.
So just
the brightness? The brightness, but even more so, I would say, the peak. Right? So measuring the absolute brightness of the sun is a little bit tricky because of changes in transparency with wavelength, but figuring out where most of the sun's light is, that's one way of figuring out the temperature. Now, it turns out that that's not the the best possible way, because this is what the sun really looks like. It doesn't really have that nice smooth curve because it's got zillions of little absorption lines in it. So while we can ballpark where the peak is, getting it down to any sort of precision for where this peak is going to be a little bit tough. So this sounds like it's a disadvantage, but it's actually going to be an advantage, as we'll talk about next time.